Oh, that's one of my all-time favorites. The Great Sonny Stitt with one of my best. I love this thing called Blues Greasy. This was recorded in 1957 for his album that year, Personal Appearance. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. And just a little recap. So far today, we have more craziness in the White House. Of course, you know of the executive order yesterday to initiate withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But today, we have the move to proceed with the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. And we have FBI Director James Comey being asked by President Trump to stay on, and he said okay. So things are just going swimmingly in Washington. Of course, we have more hearings because this has been an interesting development, too, that the president has begun his term with not too much of a cabinet to speak of that has been confirmed. So there are lots of things going on with the cabinet. The Finance Committee holding a hearing on the confirmation of Tom Price as Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. We have the Senate Judiciary Committee, remember that, meeting to vote on the confirmation of Senator Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. The Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, meeting to vote on the nomination of Ben Carson as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. The consideration of Linda McMahon, the wife of Vince McMahon of the Wrestling Federation, to be considered to head the Small Business Administration. A hearing on the confirmation of Betsy DeVos, the secretary or presumed secretary of education, which has run into a major brick wall for the time being. We don't know how that is going to work. And a hearing on the elements of the Affordable Care Act that should be dismantled first. So things are proceeding according to Trump's plans in Washington, D.C. And in a sense, part of it is the drama of it, and it is supposed to keep us constantly in a state of fear and loathing. We don't know what's going to happen. Oh my God, what's going to happen? When is it going to happen? What's going to be the problem as soon as it happens? We shouldn't be in that space at all. We know the person we're dealing with. We have a fair idea, a pretty good idea of what motivates him. We have a pretty good idea of his psychological profile, if you will. And it is reasonable to assume that that will transfer to his methods and manners of operating across the board. He has so far caused, excuse me, incredible upheavals in Washington within the bureaucracy with these crazy signals. And people are beginning, they're trying in so many ways to cover it up or to blunt the effect of what is clearly a person who's out of control, who's accustomed to being out of control, which for him is normal. And the nation is seeing how difficult it is for him to be disciplined into a way of doing things that he's just not accustomed to doing things this way. He's not accustomed to behaving this way. And it is already causing great problems for his people in trying to explain to the public what we're seeing. We're seeing a person who is erratic. We're seeing a person who is doing things according to whim and not necessarily by the book. He has to go by a book. He's not able to operate freely to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, however he wants. So it's a very interesting dynamic. But in the meantime, I think he gets a sick pleasure out of keeping people off balance with these moves. And, you know, one minute he's this way, the next minute he's in another way, he's in a different mood a couple of hours down the road. This is very unsettling, so I'm having some interesting times observing people observe him. His own people observe how he operates, and basically here it is in the open. It can't be hidden anymore that it is causing a great deal of distress, even for his own staff, as to how best to, I mean, this is no longer a public relations campaign anymore. It is there. People are seeing it. The reporters are reporting on it. And they are not letting go. So the Trump administration so far has met with a number of unanticipated battles. And they're trying to put out all these fires all at the same time. So it's interesting to watch how it will evolve. But in the meantime, I'm really paying more attention to the opposition. And I must tell you, I'm a little concerned about the opposition because I think people may have retreated a little bit. Or is it too soon to make that judgment? I don't know. But the revolution has commenced, and it is not our revolution. The revolution in Washington has started. Trump is already, I mean, he's proceeding as far as he can. But clearly the Democrats are putting up a fight. They're trying to stall these confirmations so that he gets a very late start. They're doing everything possible tactically to delay the full blast with a full cabinet. But let's be real, the Democratic Party does not really exist anymore. It has imploded. It is not in a position to put up too much of a fight. I don't see that it can gather itself or regather itself with the strength that is necessary to face down this juggernaut called the Republican Party. And even if it were to do so at the congressional level, I mean, all the state legislatures except four are in the hands of Republicans. So it's at the national level, and it's at the state level. So it's a slam dunk for 4 years. I thought we'd be seeing as this new administration starts out, even though it's off to a very shaky start. But we're not getting the sense that the Democrats have sufficiently gathered themselves for a fight. And even so, if they were to put up a fight, I don't know how effective it could be against a very well-entrenched and fortified Republican juggernaut. I just don't see it. I'll be talking about this in greater detail. But the intent here is not to even discuss really the Democratic Party. In fact, I'm hoping at some point that it does implode. It deserves to implode. It deserves to be self-destructed because it hasn't really done the job. It hasn't been useful to the masses of people at all. So it has been, it's just been there as a figment of somebody's imagination that they are in the business of serving the people. They haven't really done a good job of that at all. And the inevitable question then becomes what we have been talking about or attempting to talk about, which is, where are we? What are we doing to shore up our own defenses. Because inevitably, it will be our doing. We have to provide our own defenses. It is not our job, I don't think, to run around thinking that our job is to shore up the Democratic Party. That is not our job. And the party hasn't really deserved our support. It just has not done the job it was supposed to do. So it self-imploded. I don't see why we should waste time trying to build it up again. That's not what we ought to do. But we ought to be paying attention to those systems that could work. And we saw the huge disappointment with the Green Party. And even any of the other independent parties, they don't have their act together. And we should be seeing evidence by now of a sincere desire to figure out where they went wrong and to come back as quickly as possible with some kind of a report to the people who voted for them to say, well, this is what we've thought about what has happened and so forth. We made some mistakes and whatnot. And that's water under the bridge, but it ought to be accounted for. And this is where we headed in the next go round, and we're starting to build. But, you know, it's very important to do this kind of work and to do it immediately. But we still see the old signs of everybody has retreated after the election. And, you know, it's like it's time for a breather, retired. We need to rest up a little. Meanwhile, Trump is slashing and burning every day. He's been there and he hasn't even been there a week. He is on his mission. And we have no defenses. Who exactly is speaking for us at this moment? There's a yawning vacuum here in terms of leadership. And this is what scares me because I don't see it developing the way it ought to be developing. And certainly by now, this is why the Women's March was such a refreshing expression. But it was just that. It was an expression, a first shot. And it should have been accompanied by a whole bunch of other people from all different persuasions saying, okay, we're in it too. We are in this fight too. So people are sitting along on the sidewalk saying, hey, let's wait and see what's the next move, as if it's their responsibility to concoct the next move. No, that's our job. Our job should be about building the next move. And certainly, if not on a collective basis, but we should be well on our way to constructing something of a defense system for ourselves. Is that happening? I don't know. I'm hoping that we can see evidence of it happening, but I do know that the system is already entrenched and getting on with its business. And its business, it does not have us as the beneficiaries. That's not what it's about. This administration is about a whole different mindset, and we ought to be very single-minded now about what our reality is individually and collectively, and we must have something of a credible defense. We've got to have it, otherwise we sunk. But I want to just switch for a moment, because in the middle of all of this, we were sidelined from a story we had been following for a long time here on Lead Stories since last May, looking at the Clinton Foundation. And it was very interesting that at the inauguration of Donald Trump, we saw two familiar figures show up, Bill and Hillary Clinton. And it was a matter of, I guess, protocol. As a former president, Bill Clinton certainly was invited to be among other former presidents, five of them, witnessing the inauguration of Donald Trump. But there was an interesting thing there as I read it, two-tiered messages. On the one hand, it was part of protocol for them to show up. On the other, I was wondering, is this a way of a gesture of support meant to blunt Trump's campaign threat to probe the Clintons and the operations of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation? As you know, as you may know, the Clinton Foundation's affiliate, the Clinton Global Initiative, had filed papers indicating that it intends to shut down operations on April 15th this year. However, since it didn't file papers to say they're shutting down everything, it is to be assumed that the Clinton Foundation, its multiple entities that operate under that umbrella, will continue to operate even under allegations of massive charity fraud. And then today, with the news that James Comey, the former head of the FBI under President Obama's administration, has agreed to stay on in that same capacity under Trump administration, does that mean that Comey, who was basically in charge of investigating the Clinton Foundation and related issues pertaining specifically to Hillary Clinton, is that an indication that the prosecution will go ahead? Charles Ortel, as you know, has been with us since May, detailing the inner workings of the Clinton Foundation, of which he is an expert in terms of the investigation into charity fraud, particularly, and how the foundation in so many ways had breached the law and with apparent impunity. He joins us now. Charles, Happy New Year to you. Great to join us again. Great to be with you again.
It's my great pleasure, Yatrice.
How you been?
Well, I've been busy. I've been writing away like a demon and trying to get all this down, holding, you know, crossing my fingers and hoping that President Obama would not pardon Hillary Clinton or any member of the Clinton family or anybody involved with the Clinton Foundation who might have sought a federal pardon. And I'd like to begin this broadcast in a rare way with you, and that is to compliment President Obama and his team for not apparently pardoning the Clinton Foundation, because I think that was the correct decision. And I have been very, over years, I've been quite critical of him. But this is a case where I think he and his team made the right choice. It wouldn't have been effective to go ahead with a federal pardon because they still would stand exposed for state and foreign offenses. And I don't think former President Obama wanted the baggage associated with a federal pardon that might not have worked, because he still needs to raise hundreds of millions of dollars for his own foundation. So I was assuming he wouldn't do it, but one never knows. And
well,
now that
there is a technicality there, I don't think he could have issued a pardon without first being a charge. There never was a charge, and she certainly would not have gone to trial before he had time to leave office. So on this note, though, it is quite possible that what he was not able to accomplish, maybe this is the window of opportunity, and be getting little hints about whether this presumed prosecution of Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation, Bill Clinton as well, would proceed now, the hint being James Comey being a holdover from the Obama administration in his same capacity.
Yeah, now that's very interesting, Yatrice. I did, you know, I'll freely admit yet again on air that I am a monumental nerd, and I love details. And I was tempted not to pore through the 500-odd pages that the FBI released last week, I think Wednesday night. But I decided, you know what, I don't have much better to do. Why don't I look at every single page? And I, you know, page after page, there was little there until page 406. And starting on page 406, this document is all in the FBI vault, if your listeners want to get into it. You start to see documentary evidence released by our own FBI that on February, I think, 15th, 2001, an investigation was opened and a grand jury was subsequently impaneled twice to look into the questions. They cite the federal laws that were possibly violated involving, I think, public corruption and bribery and other things. And Bill Clinton, in connection with the fundraising for the presidential library while he was president, and I guess possibly immediately thereafter. Now, the interesting things that I saw there were there's several citations. People who are dogged can look through and create a timeline and figure out how much was spent by way of resources. And what you find is that Mary Jo White, I think, was the U.S. attorney, and then she turned the baton over to James Comey, who, as U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York in that time frame, aggressively went into an investigation, going to getting subpoenas, appearing before the grand jury, that ultimately culminated in no charges being filed by 2004. Now, this is inexplicable to me because the public record that's out there shows very clearly that this was a charity fraud in that time frame. And why am I so black and white on it? Because in this time frame, under Arkansas law, under New York law, under various laws that did apply to the Clinton Foundation, it was required to submit a legally compliant, independent, certified financial audit. And on the Clinton Foundation website, there are no such documents covering the period 1997 to 2003 when they were raising money. The other thing that's extremely interesting is that in the filings that are on the Clinton Foundation website, they provide more information than they generally should, than they needed to, but it's out there and they can't pull it back. The number of donations in this time frame through 2002 was minuscule. Indeed, it doesn't seem to me as if they disclosed all of their donations. And if you're sitting there as James Comey, a U.S. attorney with the FBI behind you, in that time frame when George W. Bush was president, for the life of me, I don't understand why they weren't able to pull together enough evidence off of the public record by pressurizing the Clinton Foundation in its filings. And this is precisely when, in 2002, 3, and 4, precisely when the Clinton Foundation started to divert from its mission and do all sorts of illegal international fundraising and then operating around these various countries without registering as they needed to do. I, for the life of me, don't understand why Comey didn't make the case then. And I think it is quite interesting and significant that President Trump decided to leave him in the mix. So there are a lot of issues here. I really hope and trust going forward that actually that Donald Trump himself will distance himself from this. And those that may have been political supporters of his on a campaign trail, if it's Sessions or others, will also distance themselves. And the American public needs to see, in this case study, an example of how the wheels of justice are blind, not ignorant, but blind, to the political affiliations of the targets. And one needs to peel away the myriad layers here and follow the myriad interconnections inside this country and numerous states and around the world, because what started believe it or not, Yatrice, in the portion of Little Rock, I found this in recent weeks of doing some research, where this library sits on the shores of the river there, it was originally known as Muddy Waters. So this foundation literally began in muddy waters, and then the ooze from the river there in the Little Rock area was then spread across our country, spread into New York City, spread into another swamp, Washington, D.C., and then spread around the world. And instead of catching this early, like a treatable cancer, and cutting the tumor out and cutting the cancer out, instead of doing that, multiple states attorney general, multiple presidents, multiple attorneys general, multiple lawyers, multiple regulators around the world look the other way. Now, why, I don't know, but they look the other way and they let this grow and grow and grow. And the fraudsters associated with this, and it's a large network, I suspect, of fraudsters, they saw that they weren't going to be caught. So they said, well, if it works for 10 million, let's try 100 million. If it works for 100 million, let's try a billion. And it just grew and grew and grew. And, you know, as I said before with you on air, I'm very certain, because I know a lot of these people here in New York City, that left-leaning people who give money to charities do so understanding, in the main, that the rules are strict and that they need to be followed. And when you get together and perform charity, it's selfless service. You're lessening the burdens of government. You're not operating a criminal conspiracy to entrench your political and build your political power and make fortunes. That's not what charities generally do. And there are a lot of, you know, people whose political views I don't share, but who perform wonderful work in the charity field, who should be horrified by this and should now be willing to work with people of other political persuasions to expose this massive fraud run illegally from New York, where there are a lot of wealthy people, a lot of high-income people, a lot of people who care about charity. This needs to be exposed. The full extent of it needs to be exposed. And it will likely touch the Bush wing of the Republican Party and the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. It's going to be a bipartisan mess, but it needs to be exposed. And it also, there's many tentacles that stretch to the UN and WHO, the Global Fund, all these multilateral organizations that we assume are doing good work but are not, in fact, carefully regulated. It needs to get into that. We need to understand if the U.S. is going to be the largest single supporter of these multilateral aid agencies, then instead of these aid agencies better not be poisoning the people they supposedly are going to help, as may have been the case with the Global Fund and Unitaid and other people who were involved in this, in theory, HIV-AIDS fight. We need to understand what really happened here. And if we're going to have, you know, a multilateral approach to charity and government action via the UN has to be accountable to somebody. And I think, you know, this exercise here, what I hope is that, you know, and in your example with me, there's a great example, and you've been so kind and generous with your time on air and to let me talk about this. And, you know, we're unlikely allies. But on this cause, I think we're very much allies. And you know, this is probably one of a number of causes in which we can be allies. And so, you know, I'm delighted to talk about it. And I'm delighted that there is, in fact, now hope that this will be fully exposed and people held accountable.
Well, the Clinton Global Initiative is going to be shut down, they say, in April. How do you read that it will shut down, but the foundation will not?
All right. So the way this works is what are the various stages of grief? You know, anger, denial, et cetera. The way this actually works, if you go onto the FBI website and look in the section about charity fraud, what you'll see is that this fits all the hallmarks of charity fraud. I mean, unfortunately, what happens when disaster strikes, when disease strikes, when you've got an audience that is sympathetic and would like to support, I mean, who's against helping children? I mean, you know, everyone wants to help children, right? So you wrap all these causes up in a nice package. You bring some celebrities around the package. You assert a need, and money comes flowing in, particularly now that we have PayPal and the Internet, and everyone's used to sending money over a phone and whatever. Tens of billions stream your way. So the standard trick is you assert this big drama and play. You don't provide the paperwork, and then you shut the charity and disappear. That's a standard approach. Now, you can't do that, actually, as a legal matter. So the rules, in particular in the state that Hillary Clinton represented as senator, in my state of New York, there unfortunately have been a long history of brigands doing just what I said, asserting there's a problem, collecting money, stealing it. So New York has special laws that are really, really tough. Now, it does have a Democratic attorney general, but it has special, extremely tough laws, both as to operating a charity, soliciting a charity, and what are really tough are when you raise money for a capital endowment, you know, which is supposed to protect a charity over a long period of time. The laws, you know, catch you multiple ways. And, you know, the Clinton Foundation filings on the Clinton Global Initiative are a joke. I mean, it started operating by their own admission through press releases in September 2005 when it was not authorized to be a party in New York, an expensive party, closed to the public, whose entry price was set far above, you know, the level where any normal human being can attend, to get in front of your connected friends and concoct deals while you brag about what you might do in the future with charity with no accounting of any kind. You're not allowed, that's, first of all, it's not a charity. It's a, you know, it's like a development exercise. It's a business deal concocting party. And, you know, that is certainly not a charity. And they had never actually granularly reported on their activities starting in September 2005. What I think, in my opinion, they got into severe difficulty is when by around 2007 or 8, this Clinton Global Initiative that didn't legally exist, that was nothing more than what's called a formless association, therefore it is invalid as a charity. It's not a corporate entity. It's not an entity that can be regulated. In theory, enters into a joint venture with a for-profit university school system that's backed at the time by, you know, people that are certainly the titans of capitalism. You know, Henry Kravis at KKR, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Paul Allen, Stevie Cohen, a whole bunch of people get together and they back this suspect enterprise. They should have known better in 2007, but they financed it, you know, at the peak of the last big bubble for deals. And the operators of Laureate, I think, bamboozled these people who should have known better. They create and leverage up this university system that, in my view, makes no sense. And this system hits the wall with the financial crisis in 2008, just at the same time that they're concocting a scheme of having a joint venture with a charity that doesn't exist. So, and they call this joint venture Clinton Global Initiative University. Now, in New York, Mr. Trump found out the hard way that you cannot market a university without in advance getting New York State Department of Education to review what you're doing and confirm that it is, in fact, a university. But they nonetheless went ahead. First, they did this. They held several sessions. And when you read about what they claim they accomplished, it's, you know, it's a good thing that marijuana is legal in many states, because whoever wrote the prose describing what they say they did certainly has a drug problem. It's just crazy stuff. And anyway, by 2010, they get Bill Clinton himself involved as chancellor of this supposed university. But they never disclose the fact that they're paying him in total from 2010 2015, over $17 million for part-time work. They never disclosed that anywhere in the Clinton Foundation filings, and they should have at that point disclosed it in the Clinton Health Access Initiative filings, of which he was basically the chairman, in Clinton Global Initiative filings, in Clinton Main Foundation filings, in the Alliance for a Healthier Generation filings, in all their affiliated filings around the world. None of this is disclosed. And the size of the Clinton Global Initiative University is minuscule. Far less than the $17.6 million that Bill was paid for part-time work. Now, why would you pay somebody that amount of money for part-time work? Could it be that you believe that because you did that, you open up special access that comes to, sometimes from politically connected people, to the International Finance Corporation, part of the World Bank, that ponies up $150 million to invest in this, Frank, I'll be blunt here, this pig. I've got nothing against pigs, but it's a pig of an investment. When they couldn't take it public in 2012, the IFC, as Hillary Clinton was exiting the State Department, the IFC and the government of Korea's sovereign wealth fund put $200 million in total to buy the riskiest slice of securities, Laureate, when its finances were hemorrhaging. $200 million. Bill gets $17.6 million. Hillary's still married to him, so she's basically getting half of that, the way the law thinks about it. And none of these filings that Hillary makes, you know, as secretary, there's no disclosure of that payment alone, $17.6 million, anywhere. It's not in the Laureate offering documents that we were trying to raise money recently. It's not in the, it's not certainly not in the Clinton Foundation documents, and it's indefensible. who pays somebody $17.6 million for part-time work? You know, I'm not sure I'd even take it if somebody offered it to me. It's just it's an indefensible sum. Of course it was a bribe. Of course it was. You know, and here you have today, you know, Congress, senators obsessed about Tom Price's stock account that he gave discretion to a broker, what happened with it. And you're ignoring this $17.6 million, this $150 million that came out of the IFC to support a suspect leveraged buyout led by KKR and Goldman Sachs and Citibank and Stevie Cohen and Paul Allen. I mean, it's just insanity. And so, you know, I'm glad we're talking about this. I hope people in the Attorney General in New York State and the Education Department in New York State are listening to your show because, you know, frankly, people who go to students who sign up to borrow money to go to these for-profit universities, here's another. I mean, I haven't, you know, found a new religion here, Yatrice, but here's another place that I'm going to...
I want to ask you, though, about... Has the Clinton Foundation finally filed all of its papers that it should have filed by last year, November?
No, it certainly has not. In New York State, you know, sometimes there's a deluge of paperwork comes into New York State and takes some time to actually get the filings up online. But as of yesterday, I did not see the New York State filings that are required for the Clinton Foundation online. And the audit, in quotes, that they provided for 2015 is certainly not compliant, nor are any of the prior audits. Now, the way audits work, it's like when you build a house. If the foundation doesn't work, then the first floor is not going to work. So if the numbers didn't work in 1997 and 1998 and all the way to 2004 when you built the campus, nothing subsequent will be right. And so they've never had legally compliant audits. They still are marketing. Bill is still aggressively raising money. And using the phone, using the internet, using possibly the mail, all of which are federal crimes.
Well, it's ironic that we have in office now a president with a similar set of problems. We have him with the university problem. We have the fact that he will not release his tax returns. He will not delineate fully all of his financial dealings and his business dealings. Interesting. And this is the president who is being looked to prosecute the former president and his former rival for the president, for the presidency. Isn't that it? Life is interesting.
Well, you know, on that one, I also share, though I don't need to, that I did not vote in 2016. So you're not speaking to a Trump partisan. And I was among the very first people on television to suggest that he absolutely needed to put his stuff in a blind trust. Damn the law, even if the law says he doesn't need to do it. In this instance, to blunt just this criticism, and in an abundance of caution, which is the way most lawyers will advise big clients like the Trump family, in an abundance of caution, I thought and think that it would have been a lot smarter for him to put his personal economic interest in a blind trust, true blind trust. And what? You didn't listen to me on that one. As far as filing tax returns, I know of no legal obligation to do that. But on the other hand, it has customarily been practiced. And, you know, it's not necessary. You're not hiding good news by hiding the tax return. So, you know, those are two places where, you know, I disagree with what he's done. And, you know, but what happens sometimes or oftentimes with these men and women who are extraordinarily successful, you know, Trump started with a leg up, but you can't say that he wasn't successful over time, particularly given his latest victory in politics. Sometimes people like that don't listen to anybody. And that could well be the case here. You know, if the president of the United States says, listen, you know, last time I checked, you're not president of the United States. I'm the one that's president of the United States. I've thought about this. This is my final decision. And by the way, those nuclear codes over there, you know, I can push them. You can intimidate a critic or an advisor into silence. And, you know, maybe on this matter, I think, you know, he's about to fight, you know, every day harder and harder. In my view, it would have been wiser to follow the course that I suggested, not just because I suggested it, but because I truly think it was the correct thing to do and it was easier. It would have proven easier for him.
Do you believe, based on the research that you have done, do you believe that the Clinton Foundation and the Clintons also got cover from the Obama administration?
Absolutely, I believe that. I mean, you know, I think that what happened here, I mean, the Clintons, if you look through their long history of getting ahead, they loved arbitrage information. By that I mean they have more information than you do, and then you sit down at a table and you strike a deal. There's never a level playing field with them. They'll tell you everything, hear the full facts, now let's negotiate. So what I suspect happened is that, you know, just looking at the available public record, and I believe, I have no inside information, but I believe that missing emails are going to come to light. They may come to light imminently. You know, it may take weeks and months. But they're going to come to light. And what those emails are going to show is that between the time that the Memorandum of Understanding was negotiated, which is either November 16th, 2008, or as late as December 12th, 2008, looking at conflicting versions of the MOU that are available online, from that moment to, let's say, early 2011, there aren't that many emails. And that's the period when Barack Obama and his people were incoming. They wanted to get across the line. He wanted to get sworn in. Whatever leverage the Clintons may have had against Barack Obama from their opposition research may have been tendered out there. I don't know. But we do know that the Clintons are the inventors of opposition research on, you know, steroids. So we can assume there was some kind of opposition research file. They negotiate this MOU, which is a joke. It's not enforceable. And if you really wanted to regulate the behavior of the Clintons, while she was Secretary of State, you would have come up with a true document that was a real agreement, where there was consideration, where there were penalties, you know, and that bound Bill Clinton and Chelsea Clinton and many other people who are not covered by that agreement, which isn't even really an agreement. So why do they even do that? Then he gets
what,
in.
What is, just before you go on, what is the Memorandum of Understanding that you're referring to? There are quite a few floating around, and when you talk about the Clintons, there's several different memoranda of understanding. What is this one that you're talking about particularly?
All right, this is the Memorandum of Understanding that was used to deceive, I would argue, the general public and the U.S. Senate into allowing Hillary Clinton to be confirmed on a basis where the Clinton Foundation would still operate. And lawyers will confirm, I mean, I've had good lawyers confirm this long ago, that a Memorandum of Understanding is like an agreement to agree. It is nothing, it is not enforceable by its terms, by its construction. So it's basically something, it's a smokescreen. You know, it's a kind of, it's like a good housekeeping seal of approval. It's meaningless, right? You know, or the National Sleep Foundation has endorsed MyPillow, and it doesn't mean anything. And so here what you have is, by design, these are Brooklyn went to Yale Law School, and other people went to some decent law schools and been around. Hillary was supposedly one of the best lawyers in the history of America, according to all these supposedly independent surveys. Why would you, to reassure the public, purposefully choose a form of document that has no force and effect? Why would you do that? Okay, you do that because you're trying to deceive the public. And indeed, you'll see, as you rightly point out, there's a lot of supposed memoranda of understanding that Bill Clinton and Iron Magazine and others entered into around the world with different national governments and union groups and trade organizations and corporations. They're all meaningless. You know, but yeah, that's the way politics works a lot of times. You say, oh, let's get a memorandum of understanding together. That'll sound good. No, show me a contract. Show me something that really has stiff penalties. And they never did that. So now he's in. Now he's sworn in. It's a historic moment, right? And he hadn't yet had control of the Justice Department and the ICE, sort of in the same place that Donald Trump is in now. Yes, he won. Yes, he's living in the White House, but he doesn't have his team fully installed. So he doesn't actually have his fingers directly on the levers of power. He doesn't know the status of all your different investigations. He doesn't know the true state of affairs of the Clinton Foundation. But after a moment in time, you know, and we don't know yet when that was, the insiders, the Obama partisans, supporters, were inside the IRS. They were inside the Justice Department, and they must have known the true state of the Clinton Foundation, and they must have been horrified. The Memorandum of Understanding does not call for the creation of a new entity to fight HIV/AIDS in it. So why did they make that decision by September 29th, 2009, when a new entity was created under Arkansas law? Why did they do that? There's going to be a record in these missing emails of that. There's going to be a record of donors complaining, saying, you know, I gave lots of money to the Clinton Foundation, but it's not showing up in their disclosures. What happened to my money? You know, governments likely are going to be asking that question. Maybe some of the big foundations and private donors are going to be asking that question. And that's what I think you're going to find in these emails, alongside discussions with donors to the Clinton Foundation getting favors in countries where the U.S. had influence around the world on natural resource projects, on telecommunications projects, on projects where a government can pick the winner or the loser. You're going to see that in these emails. And, you know, as to Trump, I hope that what he does here is, you know, let the career prosecutors run this. And if it's required, and that's not a great idea to have an independent prosecutor, because once you do that, you know, it just goes, can go haywire. I mean, in a perfect world, I'd love to see a true independent career Justice Department team looking at this with a true independent FBI team involved, with people around the world in many governments helping out, because this is well beyond the resources of the primary regulator of this charity, which is the Attorney General of Arkansas. There's no way that they have the staff to really go in and study, you know, what may have happened in the Democratic Republic of the Congo with a mining contract, because a Canadian donor may have given money to the Clinton. I mean, you're just not going to have the resources in Little Rock to do that, or even necessarily without some help in Washington, D.C. So I hope, for the benefit of all Americans and all people who care about charity around the world, that, you know, the investigations that are already in process go to a different level of intensity, start to involve subpoenas. And I also hope that the various people who have historically been associated in supporting this set of frauds, which I do think is a set of charity frauds, these are people who must now know that their days of independence and freedom are coming close to an end. And I would hope that the many people, because you couldn't do this with one person, there are probably maybe 100 people involved with this or more, that one of those people or more will understand that the first few people who come forward to the authorities with the keys to unlocking this puzzle, you know, with confirmatory evidence, I hope those people will start contacting the authorities, because this thing is going to get exposed.
Now, this thing that you call this thing, you estimate that the total dollar value, if you were to put it that way, involved in the Clinton Foundation and its ruses, its many ruses, illegal ways of raising funds, clearly pay-to-play politics going on here, involves how much money, do you think?
Well, we can start with what is known, or is, I'm not particularly fond of Donald Rumsfeld, but as he discussed, the known knowns. So the first known known is that they've declared about $2 billion in incoming donations. But when you, the first step in this is guessing how much money actually might have been sent towards the Clinton Foundation, and that's really unknown. You know, we simply don't know how much money people may have sent, how much money may have come to charities associated, affiliated with the Clinton Foundation via these internet-based campaigns, where it is rumored that billions of dollars, you know, went towards certain causes, but tiny tens of millions are declared. So we honestly don't know. But when you look at just on the nature of the charity frauds themselves, before considering the illegal private gains, I would estimate, when you count the Global Fund and Unitaid and Gavi and a bunch of these multilateral frauds that are influenced by the Clintons and affiliated with the Clintons, I think you're up at $100 billion. And then when you start to consider the illegal private gains, I think you start getting into the trillions of dollars. And I can be so expansive because, you know, the Clintons have this on their website, unfortunately for them, in a way that can't be taken down. They've disclosed their so-called commitments to action via the Clinton Global Initiative. And, you know, as an empowered set of prosecutors and investigators would be looking at that list commitment by commitment. I think there are more than 6,000 of them. There's, in one case, there's a notorious man named Gilbert Chagouri, who claims to have given $1 billion to charity as a result of the commitment. There is no evidence of that. Now, what is this Chagoury? He was a former associate of Mark Rich. He's involved in construction around the world. Who knows how many projects he may have gotten and how what projects and aid monies may have been, you know, come out of the USAID and other places where the Clintons had influence around the world, and how many of those projects then created billions and tens of billions and even more of private gain. Then we can think about the stimulus program. We can think about the Clinton Climate Change Initiative, which was a complete fraud. It was never authorized. There's never been any accounting for it, any granular understanding of what they really did. There's never been proper registration around the world. Yet this associate isn't even mentioned in the Clinton Foundation main body of work, but you'll find her online. I think her name is Ruby Chang, from memory. Bragged in an interview in Singapore that she was involved in 6,000 projects around the world. Really? 6,000 projects. There's no evidence of that in the books. So you start unpacking, you know, with determined people. A, you're going to find evidence of massive wrongdoing. And then B, and here's the good news for all of us who care about charity, private foundations, big private foundations like the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Fred Eichner's Alpha Wood Foundation, many others like that, the IRS changed the rules on them a while back and said, if and when you uncover evidence that you have given money thinking it went to a charity, to something that wasn't a charity, you have an obligation to try to get that money back. And if you don't do that, we're going to punish you, especially if it's done repeatedly. Well, the Gates Foundation has given, by its own account, about $150 million towards these fraudulent Clinton Foundation charities. And they stepped up their giving after 2009. You know, and so it's not a good record. Why? Bill Gates is a smart dude. His wife is a smart lady. There are a lot of smart people around the Gates Foundation. Why, oh, why would they have ever given money and left their name? They're considerable. It's the largest foundation in the world. Why would they have ever done what they've done? You know, there's got to be a reason. This didn't happen by chance. It's not one little grant. It's many, many, many decisions were made.
Charles, I would like to ask whether we can continue tomorrow. I know you have a very crammed schedule, because we are at a point in our conversation where we just, it's a cliffhanger to leave it here. So we'll talk later. If it's okay, we'll come back tomorrow and finish up, because there's so many questions having to do not just with the Clinton Foundation, but the parallel tracks now we see between the Clinton situation and the Trump administration. So let's continue tomorrow then. And I want to thank you for today. I've been thanking you since May for opening this can of worms up. And there's so much more that you have discovered, so we can talk about that in the next go-round.
My pleasure, Teresa. I look forward to it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That brings us to the end of our program today. And I'm telling you, a lot of work has gone on in looking at the Clinton Foundation. It is mind-boggling, the level of criminality that nobody has talked about. Really? And it also involves Obama, and it also involves Donald Trump. So there you go. This is where we need to pay our attention to and building our defenses. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You want to stay tuned for that. Always an enlightening program. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see you tomorrow with more stuff.